Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Focus on Albany Spotlight on State Government. I hope I don't have the coronavirus. Haven't shaken this yet. My guest today is Zach Williams, and he's going to talk about this week in state government. So, Zach, I would say that the overriding issue of the week has been the coronavirus, right?
Oh, I would say so. Everything started off quite literally at the beginning of the week. On Sunday, the federal government gave the states its authority to test for the virus. Monday morning, the governor announced the first confirmed case in the state. And since then, it's just grown to dozens of cases and really overshadowed everything else that this state government has been up to in the past week. There was legislation passed that gave $40 million in emergency funding, an expansion of the governor's authority over all declared emergencies. And, the governor has had 7 press conferences in the Capitol in the last 5 days. And, just to give you a sense of how big of a deal that is, last week was the first Capitol press conference he had of the entire year.
Wow. Do you think that people should be alarmed that this is going to be like, I want to use the word epidemic, I don't know what other word to use, proportions. I mean, at this point, it's conjecture, right?
Well, there certainly are, there's dozens of confirmed cases in the state, hundreds of, the state is mobilizing its resources. I think the proper term to maybe use right now is just call it an outbreak. There's a bunch of cases. It certainly is not anywhere near the level that we've seen in China, in Italy, and some other countries. But that said, the state government is taking it pretty seriously. And, the activity within the Capitol has changed accordingly. I think in terms of being worried about it, that's been a point the governor has made repeatedly through his public appearances throughout the week, that this, 80% of people that get coronavirus will likely not even know that they were carrying it, which basically means that, it had no real consequence to their health. Overall, a percent or two, maybe as high as 3% of people are estimated by scientists to, die after being infected, but it mostly hurts people that are elderly or otherwise have some type of underlying health condition. One thing that's kind of interesting is children have actually proven to be the most resilient demographic group to coronavirus, and that comes all the way from China particularly. So it's certainly a disease that deserves attention and, could spread and will spread in the coming weeks. But that said, it's hardly a death sentence when 80% of people who contact the virus are estimated to not show any symptoms at all. Of all the cases in the state right now, we're talking on Friday evening, there's 44 cases confirmed in the state right now. Only 5 of them are people that are hospitalized.
So this started, would you say this started in China?
Well, nobody knows for sure, but certainly China has been the epicenter of the disease. I think they've had, thousands of deaths. They've cordoned, entire cities, including Wuhan in Hunan province or in central China, which, appears to be where the disease started. Since then, it's spread to several other countries across the world. Now we have it here, not only in New York, but in Washington State, where a dozen people have already died. I believe there's about 250 cases confirmed across the country. And, I sat in actually on a meeting of the Cuomo administration's, top agency officials, everyone from Department of Financial Services, Superintendent Linda Lacewell, Pat Foy from the MTA, and about, nearly 24 other officials. And what I found really interesting in hearing how the governor, interacts with his, agency heads is that, he really wants to try to keep this in perspective. He certainly is making moves to get ahead of everything. And, nobody knows how much coronavirus will spread, but you know, the governor has certainly made efforts to qualify his words in a way that tries to keep people, you know, going about their daily business, taking the prudent precautions, but to avoid any sort of widespread panic over a disease that, you know, after all, is it only affecting, you know, at, you know, a few dozen people, maybe a few hundred thousand people across the state. I think there's about 4,000 people under voluntary quarantine right now, which means that basically they got to stay home for the next 2 weeks and, you know, to make sure that they don't have the disease and they're not spreading it to other people.
What was the quote that, I believe it was Rahm Emanuel had made about a crisis? And do you think that, I don't remember the exact quote, but do you think that Cuomo is using this crisis as a tool to advance himself?
Well, the quote you're referring to, which has been attributed to Rahm Emanuel, the former chief of staff to President Obama and later and now the current mayor of Chicago, is that you never let a good crisis go to waste.
Right.
And, you know, that can be taken one of two ways. One of them would be simply that, you know, you learn from a crisis and you make, you know, things bigger happen beyond just dealing with the crisis at hand. I think most political cynics latch onto it in a different way, which is if there's a crisis, you use it to expand your own power and get things done that otherwise you could not. Now, the governor, you know, last week he proposed, you know, that legislators allocate $40 million to help the State Department of Health combat coronavirus. But when he actually came up with actual legislative language on, I believe it was Monday, the funny thing is that there was another provision. It wasn't just about funding. It would also allow the governor to effectively, you know, not only suspend state laws in the event of emergency, whether it's coronavirus, flooding, or a volcano. It would also let him, you know, basically write new laws to meet that emergency. Now, there were some, you know, certain conditions within that. For instance, state lawmakers could pass what's called a continuing or you know, could pass a resolution that require a majority of both houses to overrule the governor on his emergency actions. And the law itself they passed this week would expire in April 2021. That said, a lot of lawmakers, you know, were not happy with the legislation for two reasons. One of them was that they felt it gave too many emergency powers to a governor. The second was that they were given the bill and then asked to pass it just a few hours later, which is, you know, kind of makes people skittish, because that's often one of the great sources of criticism for the state budget, you know, that nobody knows what's in it until the moment they got to pass it. And there's just not a lot of time for not only lawmakers to, you know, understand what the legislative language means, but for the public to respond as well. And this emergency legislation was passed literally in the middle of the night. The state assembly, after some debate, passed it by an overwhelming margin. I think just a dozen lawmakers voted against it in the assembly, only four in the Senate. And the assembly passed it just after midnight on Tuesday morning. And the governor signed it into law, that later that morning. So, you know, I think that while only 12 in the assembly and four in the Senate voted against it, there was a lot more opposition in both houses of the state legislature than those numbers would suggest. So, you know, in speaking with Cuomo, I spoke to him in his office on Monday. You know, he framed the necessity of the state's response, you know, in this way, that there was, you know, right now the coronavirus is more of a danger insofar as it could inspire, you know, anxiety and panic among, you know, the 20 million people across the state. But what really needed to be done was, you know, all sorts of preventative actions to make sure that if something goes amiss, everything is in place that would make it, you know, to handle it. And that could be everything from, you know, making sure that there's enough testing kits and enough face masks and other medical materials. It can also be, you know, things like, you know, unionized labor for, you know, one government department be used in another. Can, you know, will the unionized workers at the MTA be willing to, you know, do certain things that might expose them to the virus, like cleaning subway cars, for instance? You know, is there a, you know, legal language that would let, that would allow the states to not just, you know, advise people to be quarantined in their home, but that could make them do it? You know, these are all questions that had to be asked. I'd say in the meeting that I observed, that, you know, I had exclusive access to from the governor's office, you know, really was all about making sure not that there were answers to these questions, but that these questions were brought up to begin with. So that all said, you know, the governor feels he has the ball. He managed to strong arm lawmakers into giving him what he wants in this emergency legislation. He, you know, it will expire in April next year, but the governor is leaving the door open to extending it thereafter. And just the fact that it gives him authorization to not just deal with coronavirus, but with, you know, any other type of emergency that might arise in the coming year, shows that, you know, the governor's thinking ahead about how this crisis can empower him to deal with future emergencies. And not everyone is on board with that idea.
Do you think that the corona, that the state budget is taking a back seat to the coronavirus?
Well, as of last week, everybody was just talking, you know, bail reform, bail reform, bail reform. So much is ground to a halt in the state capitol, at least. You know, there were rallies like usual, all sorts of different interest groups trying to get attention for, you know, marijuana, funding for local streets, bail reform, you know, all sorts of things. But, you know, all the governor's really been talking about, 7 press conferences, you know, 98% of everything he's talking about was coronavirus. It just drowned out every other issue. And in some respects, that's kind of to the governor's benefit. You know, anytime that people are talking about, you know, coronavirus is time that they're not talking about bail reform, talking about, you know, with controversial moves to limit Medicaid spending. It's time that they're not talking about, you know, the pros and cons of legalizing paid gestational surrogacy. All sorts of issues have, you know, been drowned down this past week, and there's only 3 weeks to go until that April 1st budget deadline. If I were a state lawmaker, I'd be wondering, you know, how can coronavirus work for me? You know, some proponents of single payer healthcare, for instance, have said, you know, coronavirus and, you know, all these worries about, you know, do people, you know, working people need to pay for, you know, testing or vaccines or hospital treatment or whatever, you know, maybe that's a way to promote single payer healthcare. I think Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez made that very argument a day or two ago. You know, with the you know, the governor himself has said that there could be incredible costs borne by the state to deal with coronavirus. Maybe that's an argument that lawmakers can make to raise taxes on the wealthy. You know, the next couple of weeks will show not only how the state deals with coronavirus, but how state lawmakers incorporate this issue into the vision they want to enshrine in the budget they'll have to pass at the end of the month.
Now, you work for city and state. You cover what's going on in Albany. Is the 49 other governors as visible as Governor Cuomo is talking about this issue?
Well, you know, we live in a silo up there on the third floor of the Capitol, so I don't necessarily have the best perspective. I think, you know, one governor who has gotten a lot of attention because of coronavirus is Jay Inslee in Washington. I think a lot of people might remember him from early in the presidential campaign when he was running for the Democratic nomination, largely on climate change. Now, you know, he's back in Olympia. He's in charge of his state's response to coronavirus. I don't know too many of the details of, you know, pro or con, whether he's doing a great job. There have been, you know, a dozen deaths, I believe, in his mostly in his state, if I'm not incorrect. But by and large, it looks like, you know, he, you know, has risen to the challenge and things are more or less under control over there. California has been, you know, is probably the other biggest state along with New York that has, you know, an outbreak to deal with. Gavin Newsom certainly cuts in some ways a similar political profile as Governor Cuomo here. But I think it's safe to say that, you know, Governor Cuomo is going to be, you know, has been making the national media rounds all week, CNN, Friday night, 2020 on ABC, you know, is getting a lot of attention. And that's, you know, one of the things that makes him tick, not just talking about coronavirus, but presenting himself not just to the state, but to the nation as the can-do, you know, putting the progress and progressive governor of New York who rises above politics. This is the image he wants to have, not the, you know, dare I say, cutthroat, you know, master of the New York State Capitol who, you know, is the object of a lot of criticism in his day-to-day job. That's changed with coronavirus. And as I wrote earlier this week in a piece calling him the master of disaster, you know, Cuomo feels pretty comfortable in the driver's seat whenever there's a crisis around.
So give us an update on the bail reform issue for the week.
Well, I think, you know, the big thing is the mathematical battle over the criminal justice reforms that went into effect on January 1st. You know, new crime data came out from the NYPD this week. The police and Mayor Bill de Blasio claim that there was an uptick in a bunch of different crime categories. Public defenders and supporters of the reforms have argued otherwise. So I think the big thing is to look, you know, is to dive into numbers if you can. You know, they both have their conflicting interpretations, you know, and I think the key difference is police are focusing on how many arrests there are, whereas advocates are talking about how many people are actually charged. So think of it this way. If you got somebody that's arrested for robbery, for instance, and then the prosecutors don't charge them for whatever reason, the pro-reform people are going to say, well, that shouldn't count in terms of crime data, whereas the police will say it should count. So if we're comparing to last year's data on robberies and we see we, you know, have 20 of them in February and only 10 of them in February of 2019, but 10 of those were robberies that weren't charged, then you could argue, as the supporters of the reforms are arguing, that those shouldn't count, that there were 10 people arrested in February 2020 and the same amount in 2019, and they were, you know, the same number was charged. So how could you say crime has gone up? The police and, you know, critics of bail reform, they got their own take on that. But there's been several reports coming from both sides in the past week that, you know, have been trying to, you know, really craft the media narrative and the impression the public has of what those numbers mean and how it should relate to changing or not changing these new limits on cash bail.
So the other big news for the week is former Mayor Bloomberg decided to drop out of the presidential race. So give us your take on that, please.
Well, I think it just goes to show that even when you have unlimited financial resources, as Bloomberg did, you can't buy, you know, elections, at least not in the presidential primary in 2020. You know, Bloomberg spent $500 million in just a few months running for president, and all it really bought him were a few delegates and a win in the American Samoa primary.
Right.
You know, this past week was Super Tuesday. He had bet the whole shop on it. You know, he had skipped Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina. He was supposed to do really well, win a bunch of states, take that moderate mantle away from former Vice President Joe Biden, but the exact opposite happened. Joe Biden, you know, slumped through the first couple contests, won huge in South Carolina, and somehow that momentum, you know, brought him the victory in states where he didn't even really campaign. You know, he won Massachusetts, Minnesota, these states where he spent nothing. And, you know, Bloomberg spent millions of dollars on TV, radio, internet advertising. And in the end, he basically got diddly squat. And, you know, you can at least say that, you know, the guy knew when he was beat. He didn't need to look that hard at the data. It was, you know, just as clear as day. You know, he spent a bunch of money, he lost, and he dropped out of the race.
Do you think the debates hurt him? I mean, he wasn't exactly a ball of fire at the debates.
I think they did. We'll never know to what extent, but, you know, he was riding pretty high, got a lot of good favorable press coverage, you know, before the debates. He was spending tons of money in all these states that I just mentioned. And then he got on the debate stage and, you know, Senator Elizabeth Warren, among other people, really tore into him on, you know, the non-disclosure agreements that women that worked at his company had to sign after settling sexual harassment complaints, you know, his vast wealth and what that means in the Democratic race in 2020. You know, and he just didn't respond well. It's kind of surprising, you know, how even all the money in the world could not buy him, you know, the right sound bites at the right time to, you know, to help him take advantage of that big, you know, opportunity he had on the national stage on television, where he could show that he wasn't just a candidate who, you know, was in TV commercials, you know, developed by others, but he was a real human who could connect with voters and stand up to scrutiny. And he couldn't. He, you know, some of his responses just seemed out of touch, especially with the Democratic electorate in 2020 that just, you know, isn't the same as when he won those big elections in New York City with a lot of Democratic support. Now, you know, more than 10 years ago. So, you know, I think it did hurt him. We'll never know, you know, exactly to, you know, how much it did. But, you know, when you skip the first couple contests in the presidential campaign, you need all the help he can get. And he didn't get much help at all from television in those debates.
I remember that's kind of reminiscent of Giuliani, when Giuliani placed all his eggs in the basket of Florida, and he lost pretty big at that point. So to me, it was like an analogy. What do you think?
Yeah, I think there is something to be said. You know, keep in mind that Michael Bloomberg is one of many, and I think just about every New York City mayor, except for David Dinkins, in the last half century or so has thought that he could run and win the presidency, going all the way back to John Lindsay back in the 60s. And, you know, Bill de Blasio, dare I say, kind of humiliated himself running for president, you know, had almost no support at all. He, you know, was this object of ridicule by the New York City press corps. And Rudy Giuliani didn't do much better when he ran in 2008. One thing that's interesting is that, at least in the case of Giuliani and Bloomberg, neither of them ran for president. Maybe you could say for de Blasio too. Neither of them really ran for the presidency when they were at their peak popular support. Imagine a world where Rudy Giuliani could have ran for president in 2004. Of course, George W. Bush was running for re-election there, so that world would take a little bit of imagination. But, you know, that's when he was America's mayor. Not in 2008, when, you know, the world had kind of moved on to some extent from, you know, from 9/11's aftermath to the hope and change that would take, you know, Barack Obama to the presidency. The same thing happened with Michael Bloomberg. You know, 10 years ago, when New York City, you know, had recovered from 9/11, you know, was prospering under, you know, Bloomberg's mayoralty, and a lot of the controversies hadn't quite, you know, come up in the public consciousness. You know, Black Lives Matter, you know, didn't come around until 2013, 2014 when de Blasio was mayor. You know, maybe Bloomberg could have done better. You know, at that time he was younger, so he didn't have to deal with the age issues. He didn't have as much, you know, criticism in the public record. He still would have faced a lot of headwinds, but I think he would have done better at least back then with $500 million than he sure did in 2020.
Now, this morning when you and I were exchanging ideas, you had mentioned Howie Hawkins. How does Howie Hawkins fit into this?
Well, Howie Hawkins, some of your listeners might remember him from his various political campaigns, gubernatorial campaigns. You know, he's the front runner right now for the Green Party nomination for president, the only New Yorker left standing now that President Trump has moved to Florida. So, you know, in a very curious way, Howie Hawkins is now carrying the mantle for the Empire State. you know, the tricky thing will be if Bernie Sanders somehow pulls it out and gets the Democratic nomination, because, you know, a self-described socialist is not the normal opponent the Green Party is railing against in a presidential election. And things could be close, you know, if Bernie Sanders, you know, is running neck and neck with Trump in states like, you know, Florida, Ohio, the Midwest, these various other swing states, you know, a percent or two of the vote that goes to Howie Hawkins on the Green Party line could hurt the Democrats. You know, we'll see. I would think that if Joe Biden gets the nomination, the Green Party is not going to have any qualms attacking him as a, you know, a corporate shill and, you know, an enemy of progressive change. But if Bernie gets it, I think there might be some soul searching in the Green Party about just how hard they should complain against him. And you got to keep in mind, though, that the Green Party at least has to do fairly well, or they could risk their ballot access in states across the country. And for a third party, that's a, you know, pretty tough thing to get once you lose it.
Well, the last time I spoke to Howie Hawkins, he said that it's going to be very difficult for the Green Party to be on the ballot for president in 2020. Have you heard anything more about that?
You know, I think it's always going to be hard for the Green Party. You know, they typically, I think their best showing might have been in 2004 when, or 2000 when Ralph Nader was running. I think it was in 2000 when Ralph Nader ran it and was accused of being a spoiler for Al Gore. You know, it's just hard. You know, all the states have different requirements for getting on their ballot. But, you know, in New York, for example, to run for governor, you needed, you know, you needed 50,000 votes in the last gubernatorial campaign. The Green Party usually did pretty well, at least better than some other third parties. But, you know, every year, every presidential election is going to be a struggle for the Greens, for the Libertarians, for the Peace and Freedom Party, you know, where the in the states where they're active. And I don't think there's any reason to think 2020 will be any different. Especially given how, you know, how people are either for or against Trump. And if they're against Trump, they're, you know, typically looking to the Democrats. They're not looking as much to just make a political statement by voting for the Green Party and risking, you know, Trump winning re-election.
Our time is almost up, Zach. So, like always, give yourself a little plug.
Well, I'm the Albany reporter for City and State magazine. Follow me on Twitter at Zach Reports. And we got a new noontime newsletter that comes out with the latest on what's going on in the state capitol. You know, go to our website, cityandstateny.com, and you can sign up and keep in touch.
Thanks, Zach. We'll talk next week. And you've been listening to Zach Williams. This is Focus on Albany, Spotlight on State Government. Thank you, everybody. We'll talk next week. Have a good week, everyone.